the GLP-1 receptor is a receptor. It's expressed not only in the brain, but in peripheral tissues. And it has one ligand or one endogenous molecule that activates it, and that's GLP-1. So GLP-1 in peripheral tissues is made primarily in the intestine, but it's also made by a subset of neurons in the brain. So in the periphery, the source of GLP-1 in the circulation is coming from specialized endocrine cells in the GI tract. And in the brain, the GLP-1 is coming from neurons.
Welcome to the GLP-1 Podcast Show, a monthly podcast where you'll find cutting-edge insights and all that's working in the world of metabolic health and obesity care. Our aspiration is to be the first place you are going to go to find out what's happening, the latest updates, and the latest research in GLP-1 science and clinical practice.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the first episode of the GLP-1 Podcast Show. My name is Arisha Moyes. I am a clinical researcher from McGill University in Montreal, Canada. And today we're diving into one of the most exciting areas in medicine right now, or at least I think so. And I might be a bit biased because this is my area of research, but we're going to be talking about GLP-1 receptor agonists, or GLP-1s for short. I'm honored to be joined here today by Dr. Michael Schwartz, who is the Robert H. Williams Endowed Chair and Professor of Medicine at the University of Washington. Dr. Schwartz is internationally recognized for his groundbreaking work in diabetes and obesity research. He has published nearly 300 peer-reviewed papers, served as founding director of the University of Washington Diabetes and Obesity Center of Excellence, as well as co-director of the University of Washington Diabetes Institute. He has received numerous awards, including the Roy O. Greep Award for Outstanding Research from the Endocrine Society, and most recently, the 2024 Distinguished Lecturer of the Western Association of Physicians. So thank you so much, Dr. Schwartz, for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
So today we're going to be talking about your recent talk on GLP-1s and how they act on the adaptive response to weight loss. So I listened to this lecture. I found it really fascinating and insightful. And many of our listeners have probably heard of these drugs, semaglutide, tirzepatide. So today we're going to explore how they act on the brain, what this tells us about the biology of weight regulation, and fundamentally why these drugs seem to be more effective than past obesity medications. So to start off, and I know this is kind of the overarching idea of your talk. So if you don't want to answer this right away, we can get to it at the end. But what makes GLP-1 receptor agonists different from older generation of weight loss drugs?
Right. Well, it takes a while to kind of get into all the weeds there. But there are a number of things that are different. So maybe we should just start with the most obvious ones. So just to clarify, the GLP-1 receptor is a receptor. It's expressed not only in the brain, but in peripheral tissues. And it has one ligand or one endogenous molecule that activates it, and that's GLP-1. So GLP-1 in peripheral tissues is made primarily in the intestine, but it's also made by a subset of neurons in the brain. So in the periphery, the source of GLP-1 in the circulation is coming from specialized endocrine cells in the GI tract. And in the brain, the GLP-1 is coming from neurons. So what makes these drugs interesting, in a sense, is that the way that they're designed now, like semaglutide or tirzepatide, is that they have a super long half-life, and they're super potent at activating the GLP-1 receptor. And so they achieve high levels. And of course, because of the long half-life and you get an injection, say, once a week, basically the design of the administration of these drugs is that you have high levels in the circulation all the time. They never come down. So that's kind of unusual to, at least in the world of endocrine pharmacology, that you would be trying to activate a receptor system not just to replace the normal amount of activation, but to turn it on maximally and continuously and to never stop. So that's kind of a new paradigm in pharmacology, is to take that approach. But the other point that's important here is that the circulating GLP-1 levels normally are so low that they probably don't do very much in the brain. They just don't really get into the brain very well. But when you boost the level and the potency, like with semaglutide, then the brain becomes a real target for these drugs. So even though we think about incretins, which is, you know, another name for these drugs, incretin mimetics, because the GLP-1 in the intestine is an incretin, which means that it's a peptide that's secreted during a meal that then increases the amount of insulin is going to be secreted during the meal, and it helps to control the blood sugar through that mechanism. But that's probably not really what these drugs are doing. The drugs are achieving much higher levels and having direct effects on the pancreas and direct effects in the brain that would not really be occurring with the circulating GLP-1.
Wisenetics turns podcast airtime into brand authority. We don't sell ads, we elevate voices. If you're ready to boost your authority in the industry, access wisenetics.com and speak with a brand authority specialist. Let's transform expertise into influence. Starting now.
It's interesting that you mentioned semaglutide and tirzepatide for having a longer half-life. So how did these drugs compare to older GLP-1s like liraglutide or dulaglutide or exenatide even?
I can't give you, you know, the specific details, you know, because I haven't really compared them. But, you know, if you were to go to look at, for example, Novo Nordisk or Eli Lilly, who makes these drugs, you could see the comparison of the half-lives. Okay. But, you know, GLP-1 half-life, the native peptide is only a few minutes. Mm-hmm. And the half-life of semaglutide is days. Mm-hmm. So it's much, much longer. And the way that they achieve that is they modify the peptide by attaching what's called a free fatty acid onto it. And the free fatty acid binds onto albumin. Albumin is a protein in the bloodstream that has a very long half-life. And so once you take the injection, the drug binds onto albumin, and it just sticks on the albumin and stays in circulation for days. So that's how they increase the half-life.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I was mainly asking because, you know, these newer agents are more potent in terms of weight loss compared to, you know, liraglutide, which was used for diabetes management for the past decade or so. So I guess kind of tying into the bigger question, the adaptive response, where in the brain are these drugs acting and what's happening there that allows them to influence appetite and energy balance so effectively?
Let me try to answer that by providing a little bit of background. Mm-hmm. Many of your listeners probably are familiar with the experience of trying to lose weight just by, say, a calorically restricted diet. And you can certainly lose weight by going on a very low calorie diet. But the problem is that over time, you tend to regain the weight. And the reason that you tend to regain the weight is related to a physiological system that we call energy homeostasis. So energy homeostasis is a biological process that over long time intervals matches up energy intake to energy expenditure so that the amount of fuel stored in the body as fat remains relatively constant. If you deliberately try to change the amount of body fuel stored as fat by going on a weight-reducing diet, you will activate the energy homeostasis system in ways that will promote increased caloric intake. That effect is that you'll enter a state of positive energy balance until you regain the lost weight. So the energy homeostasis system is protecting you against weight loss. You know, if you're trying to lose weight, that's maybe troublesome, but that's the way the system works. In fact, the tendency to regain lost weight is the single biggest obstacle to effective weight loss. So if you're going to have effective weight loss, you have to overcome the tendency to regain lost weight. Now, in most mammals and in normal humans, the threshold for activating the adaptive response to weight loss is about a 5% weight loss. So once you've lost about 5% of your body weight, it gets much harder to lose weight. And once you stop the intervention, the adaptive response to weight loss will push you back up to where you started from. So the question that you're asking, how is it that these drugs like semaglutide blow right past that 5% threshold, past 10%, past 15%, even down to 20%, or with tirzepatide, more than 20% weight loss? So these drugs are pushing the body weight 4 to 5 times below the threshold where the adaptive response to weight loss would normally be activated. And so one can speculate that, well, maybe they achieve that effect by inhibiting the normal adaptive response to weight loss in addition to reducing food intake. So if you want to then talk about where do those effects occur in the brain, the main target for these drugs is an area of the hindbrain. There's two areas right next to each other where there's a lot of GLP-1 receptors concentrated. One is so-called nucleus of the solitary tract, and the other is called the area postrema. And together, these are two of the three components of what's called the dorsal vagal complex. So this is all also where all the input that's traveling on the vagus nerve is also connecting right in that same place. And really, there are all kinds of signals that are transmitted from the stomach or intestine to the brain. So the brain knows, am I eating or not? So that information is a two-way street of traffic, but it all goes through the area postrema and the nucleus of the solitary tract, which is right where these GLP-1 drugs are acting. So that's where you get the sense of satiety, the reduced interest in eating. That's also where you activate responses that can make you feel sick, which is a common consequence of these drugs. A significant minority of patients who take semaglutide, for example, will experience nausea or even vomiting, at least transiently when they start. Usually it goes away over time. And so all of those effects are originating in the dorsal vagal complex. But those neurons in the dorsal vagal complex are ascending to brain areas like the hypothalamus, which is where the adaptive response to weight loss is regulated. So there's communication between the hindbrain regions that are directly responding to the GLP-1 drugs and the hypothalamic areas that are controlling the adaptive response to weight loss.
Okay. So in essence, not only they're acting on your appetite, your satiety, but additionally, they're inhibiting this adaptive response, which kind of leads to increased hunger and reduced metabolism in patients who have lost around 5% of your weight. That's what you're saying.
That's what I'm saying. Now, you know, there are other people in the world, in the world of science, who may have a different take on that. But when I look at the various pieces of evidence, you know, whether you're looking at subjective measures of appetite, which would normally go way up when you've lost weight, or whether you're looking at brain region activation, which is also detectable with weight loss and is blocked by drugs like tirzepatide, or whether you're looking at the neural circuits and looking at neurons that are activated or inhibited by weight loss in the presence or absence of these drugs, that's how I put it together.
To clarify, you're saying this effect only happens when the patients are actively on the drug, correct? So once the drug has been taken away, they're more susceptible to the weight regain that other patients experience.
Exactly, because the drugs were hiding, you know, the adaptive response to weight loss so that the brain didn't know how much weight was being lost. But when you stop the drug, you pull away the curtain and all of a sudden the brain says, wait a minute. My body weight is way down here. It's supposed to be up here, and it activates responses that rapidly recover lost weight.
I think it's interesting that you mentioned this, because I think you also referenced the step one extension study in your talk, but similar results have been seen in, you know, the step four trial, as well as the surmount four trial, which were maintenance studies of semaglutide and tirzepatide. And they showed that most patients regain from 2/3 to 100% of the weight that they had lost within a year or so. So you're saying that this rapid weight regain has to do with the adaptive response that's kind of reactivated as soon as these drugs are taken away.
That's right.
And that's really interesting, because there have been, you know, some hypotheses going around about, you know, is this a reflection of these participants no longer being monitored as closely as in a trial setting? If it has to do with more of like a psychological aspect of, you know, waiting, eating, like emotional eating, or has it have to do with like your appetite, which is increased after the withdrawal, which is what you're suggesting with this adaptive response. So I think it's really interesting idea.
I mean, I, you know, certainly be open to people who argue that it's multifactorial and you don't want to say it's just one thing.
Yeah.
And that's fine. I mean, if you're no longer, you know, part of a study, you're not being monitored as rigorously, that might be a factor. But I notice in that step one trial, if you look at the weight recovery data, that there's a rapid increase of body weight that converges on that 5% threshold. Mm-hmm. 5% below where they started. And that 5% threshold is exactly where the adaptive responses to weight loss are activated. So once you get to that 5% threshold, it's easier to maintain the 5% because you're not activating those adaptive responses anymore.
So you're saying when the patients, the participants do regain the weight, a vast majority of them kind of stay off at that 5% threshold.
Well, that's what was in that step one trial.
Yeah.
And you can see that in other trials too, where, you know, it is important to measure these things over the long term. So if you're just looking over a period of weeks or months, you can miss this. You know, there's older data looking at people who lost huge amounts of weight through consuming a very low calorie diet. So they might've lost 100 pounds, 150 pounds. Or, for example, The Biggest Loser, that type of the TV show that where people were in a competition to lose weight. Well, those people do tend to regain lost weight. And if you look at the average time course, it takes about a year to regain, on the average, about 60% of the weight that you lost. It takes about 5 years to regain 90% of the weight that you lost. And that 90% is getting you close to, you know, the threshold for activating the adaptive response. So on the average, this is a process that evolves over years. Some people it occurs very quickly, some people it occurs very slowly, but you have, if you're not monitoring it over several years, then you can't really assess what's happening, in my view.
I think it's really interesting that there's sort of this biological basis, you know, proposed for this weight regain versus just, you know, these ideas that are kind of circulating all over. So based on what we know now, is there anything we could use to kind of target specific therapy to kind of maintain this weight loss, or maybe even prolong it or extend it?
Yes, that's a great question. And there are a number of pharmaceutical companies and, you know, small biotech companies that are going after that, because that obviously is a huge niche. And not only because, I mean, you know, I can't quote you the data, but my understanding is that a substantial percentage of patients who lose a lot of weight on these drugs will eventually stop taking the drugs.
Yeah.
You know, sooner or later, maybe a year, maybe 2 years, maybe 3 years, but eventually people stop taking the drug.
Yeah.
For one reason or another. One of the reasons is that they're still very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be that your insurance isn't covering it, or you just don't want to spend the money, or you feel like, well, now I've lost, you know, 25% of my body weight, I can keep it off, you know, so I'm just going to stop the drug and see what happens. So it would be great if there was an alternative that was, say, more affordable, easier to take, you don't have to take an injection. It doesn't give you nausea and vomiting and these other problems, but it just allows you to keep the weight off. And so the reason that I think this is an important question is because it dovetails into what I was just saying, which is the best way to keep the weight off is to continue to convince the brain that you're not underweight. So in other words, to continue to suppress the adaptive response to weight loss. And there are other ways of doing that besides giving these GLP-1 drugs. They're not drugs that do it, but in theory, if you understand the underlying biology, there are targets that you could go after that would do this. So I'll give you just a couple of examples. There are neurons in the hypothalamus that are called AGRP neurons because they express a peptide called AGRP. They express other peptides as well, and I won't go into all the background about them, except to say that they are reliably activated by weight loss. They're in the hypothalamus. They're sensing when you're losing weight. They're very good at that. And we know from studies in experimental animals that if you block the activation of those neurons, you will not get the normal recovery of lost weight. So those neurons, the activation of those neurons is required for normal weight recovery. We also know that they're inhibited by the GLP-1 drugs, not directly, but downstream. So the GLP-1 drugs are acting down in the hindbrain, and those neurons send projections and sort of a multisynaptic pathway that eventually will converge on the AGRP neuron and block its activation. Now, that may not by itself be explaining the entirety of the blocking of the adaptive response to weight loss, but I view it more as representing, you know, there are probably multiple neuron populations that are activated in response to weight loss, but AGRP would be sort of the prototype. And so if you can come up with drugs that will block the activation of these neurons, they may not be super good at causing weight loss in the first place, because you don't really need the adaptive response to weight loss in a normal individual. Where it becomes important is when you've already lost weight. So if you do something that causes weight loss, whether it's GLP-1 or something else, if you block those neurons that are basically driving the adaptive response, then you should be able to keep off the weight. And so there is an interest in, there are potential drug compounds that could limit or impair the activation of AGRP and related neurons after weight loss has occurred. And so it will be very interesting to see whether using those is able to help you maintain weight loss. And there are trials underway, as I understand it right now, that are looking at that question. The other way to do it is it's a little more complicated. The AGRP neurons are located in a brain area in the hypothalamus that in normal obese, well, in obese humans and in obese animals, you end up getting inflammation in that brain area in association with the obesity. And so one hypothesis that has pretty good support is that the reason that, or one mechanism that contributes to weight gain in individuals who become obese, is that as you start to gain weight, the inflammation and the reaction of these glial cells in this area of the hypothalamus is impairing the ability of the AGRP and the related circuits to respond. And so they remain relatively more active. They're not being inhibited by the weight gain the way that they should. And so my point about bringing this up is that there are groups, there are companies out there that are using drugs that block this inflammatory response. And if you, they have evidence in animal models that if you block this inflammatory response in the hypothalamus, after the animal has lost weight on semaglutide, the animal will keep the weight off. Okay. So in other words, if you're even if you've lost weight, but if you started out being obese, you lose weight. If you get rid of the inflammation that was present in that brain area, then the brain may not view you as being underweight. It may feel like, oh, this is okay now, and it will maintain that lower body weight.
Okay, I see. So the idea is first we can help patients lose weight with these GLP-1s. Then the second step would be to target either directly these AGRP or related neuron groups, or in another way to target the inflammation in the hypothalamus, which kind of impair the ability of the HRP neurons to be inhibited, right? So it's more downstream versus the direct effects.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So based on all of this, how close do you think we are to really understanding the full mechanisms of brain of GLP-1s when it comes to the brain? Or are there any big questions that you'd like to see answered in upcoming research?
I don't have an inside line on what these big pharmaceutical companies are doing right now. I know there are lots of different compounds that are in the pipeline that, you know, build on this idea of a dual agonist like tirzepatide, where the difference between tirzepatide and semaglutide is, whereas semaglutide is basically a long-acting preparation of a GLP-1 receptor agonist drug that will activate the receptor, tirzepatide takes the GLP-1 agonist and then adds on agonist for another receptor, which is called the GIP receptor. Mm-hmm. So now you have two different peptide agonists in the same long-acting molecule. And it turns out that when you add the GIP receptor agonist to the GLP-1, you get a greater weight loss effect. It's also more effective for lowering blood sugar in patients with type 2 diabetes. Mm-hmm. And now there are triple agonist drugs. And not only that, there are all kinds of different combinations of these different types of drugs. So there's about 8 different agonists that are being tested in various combinations that are in these pipelines at these large pharmaceutical companies. And some of them will probably start, they're in advanced clinical trials, and we'll probably start seeing them get FDA approval, you know, in the coming months would be my guess. I mean, I don't have a timeline for that. Mm-hmm. But the point that I'm trying to make is that most of that work, in my view, in my humble opinion, is, you know, basically empirical. Let's try this combination and see what happens, rather than asking the question that you asked, which is there a scientifically rational basis for blocking the adaptive response to weight loss in combination with these drugs that are so good at causing weight loss, and exploiting that as a therapeutic opportunity? And so one thing that I'm hoping might come from this type of a podcast is people who are making these drugs in the pharmaceutical world thinking, you know, maybe if we go after the adaptive response to weight loss, you know, rather than just trial and error with these different drug combinations, we can arrive at a better place.
Well, thank you so much for breaking that down so clearly for us today. I think it's very, very insightful and very interesting, and we're very grateful to have you joining us today. So I hope our listeners will walk away with a deeper understanding of like how these drugs work and what's kind of preventing them from maintaining that weight loss after the drugs are withdrawn.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
Thank you. So that concludes our episode of the GLP-1 podcast show presented by Wisenetics. We will be posting this on all podcast streaming services as well as YouTube. So don't forget to subscribe to stay updated on future episodes. And if you enjoyed today's episodes, please leave a like or comment. We'd love to hear from you. Until next time, this is Arisha Moyes from the GLP-1 podcast show signing off.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.